This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have some more advice on how to deal with cats who are driving you crazy, particularly cats who bite and cats who are doing their business outside the litter box. My guest, Dr. Nicholas Dodman, is the author of the new book, The Cat Who Cried for Help. He recently spoke with us about dogs. Dodman directs the behavior clinic at the Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. Dodman has a different take on disciplining cats than the one we presented a few weeks ago in an interview with naturalist and biologist Roger Tabor. Tabor said it's difficult to discipline a pushy cat because, unlike dogs, cats aren't pack animals. Cats are loners who don't function within a hierarchy or pecking order and therefore don't respond to your attempts to exert authority over them. Nicholas Dodman has been rethinking cats and dominant behavior. He says you can command your cat's respect, and cats do have some history of pack behavior.
If a cat occupies a very large territory with sparse resources, it can become, you know, a solitary predator, which is our typical sort of idea of a cat, you know, the cat who walks by himself. But if food resources are plentiful, then cats will happily coexist in groups of 60 or 80, frequently in my practice, groups of sort of 20 and 40 inside one household, as long as the food is copious. And instead of just being an aggregation around a food resource, just kind of by chance happening to be there, they actually do have some kind of social organization that in the past has been described as a despotic hierarchy, with one leader or alpha cat who is the despot and everybody else second in command. But in fact, it's now regarded as being even more complicated than that, that they have various time-sharing arrangements, they have very subtle ways of communicating their friendship with other cats, and they do have preferred associates, sort of colleagues, and they also have other cats that they will choose to ignore, as it were, enemies.
So when a cat starts to think that it's the dominant player in the house and it tries to bully its mm-hmm. owner, is the owner likely to be the kind of owner who is not much into disciplining the pet, who's what we call spoiling the pet?
Well, I think so. I can't really prove that. I've tried with dogs to demonstrate, you know, certain, you know, owner personality factors, and, you know, bordered on significant findings in some cases, but haven't quite conclusively proven it. But from just experience, you know, it does seem that the owners of dominant dogs and the owners of dominant cats do seem to be, you know, pretty nice human beings, really. I mean, they're sort of compliant and, you know, giving to the pet and make allowances. You know, they don't drive a hard bargain. They're pretty compliant individuals, you know, probably nice people to meet. But a dominant cat who by nature is dominant will take advantage of these kind of compliant people and will start insisting that it gets its own way in any one of a number of different situations. I mean, one, for example, I remember one lady told me that whenever she fell asleep in a particular armchair, her alpha cat would come up and bite her in the hand because it, you know, it had been deprived of her company and it wasn't going to allow her to sleep. And they'll also jump through the middle of a newspaper that you're trying to read to get your attention, or sit right on the print that you happen to be reading at that time.
Why would the cat bite you when you're petting her or him?
Well, for the same reason that dogs do. I mean, if, you know, there's many reasons why cats might bite you, but in this specific instance of petting-induced aggression, if it's a dog or a cat, the animal will approach you, will solicit your attention. The cat may jump into your lap and, in a way, is demanding, you know, not requesting, but demanding to be petted. And, you know, the owner thinks, well, this is kind of cute, and slides the hand up into the petting position and pets them. But the dominant dog and the dominant cat, when they've had enough, they repel boarders. And if you're looking very carefully, you will see in a cat sort of just slight sideways glances, just a slight turn of the head, very subtle signs that enough is beginning to be enough. And you'll also see a very slight twitching of the tail. That's the time to stop, because if you go on beyond that, trying to appease the cat further, it will bite you in the hand. And the message is, you know, to you is, cut it out. So they'll demand to be petted and then demand for you to stop when they've had enough.
So what's the solution? Obviously, the goal isn't to just be so attuned to your cat's every gesture that you know precisely when to pet and not to pet and what your cat wants and when your cat wants it, because then you become even more subservient to the cat. How do you get control over the cat?
That's right. You can't win your way over a cat like that by, you know, continued spoiling. There are several ways that you can address it, but I use a kind of modified dog dominance control program that in dogs at least is referred to as nothing in life is free. Some people call it working for a living or no free lunch. And what you do is you introduce some kind of structure, and everything, all the good things in life that the cat would normally take for granted come from you, and you make a point that things do come from you. Without, you know, there's no yelling, no hitting, no, you know, bad treatment of the animal. You just simply insist that things are done a certain way until the cat has to respect you. In other words, you're not demanding respect, you're commanding respect. And one way to start this is to train your cat. And in my view, a good way to train a cat is with this so-called click-and-treat training. So what you do is you take one of these, you know, $3 party favor little plastic clickers, and first of all, you pair a food treat with the click. So the cat actually comes to think of the click as being, you know, almost a reward in its own right, because it's going to be followed by a reward. And then you can train your cat to sit or jump up or do whatever it does naturally, and it's good to go with the flow, and click whatever behavior you like and immediately follow it by a reward. You know, in this method, for example, I've trained my cat to sit when I feed it so that it walks up towards me. And initially it was just I would wait for it to do some behavior that I thought was desirable, and it happened to sit. So I clicked that behavior and rewarded it. Later I introduced the word sit. So as recently as this morning, I looked at the cat, whose name is Cinder. I said, "Cinder, sit." And I hadn't done it for a while, so she, but about 3 seconds, and then, oops, she sat down. And now I don't even have to use the clicker because she's trained to the word sit, and I can feed her food.
So the point of all of this isn't just to get on the David Letterman show with a stupid pet trick. It's to show that you're the boss, and good behavior will be rewarded with food. And otherwise, what, no food? I mean, do you not feed the cat if the cat doesn't sit?
Well, not, you know, you don't stop feeding the cat forever, but you would, you know, to be able to use this tool, you'd need to put your cat on twice daily feeding rather than, you know, free choice. And when you give the morning meal, you would require for this behavior, you know, be fair, of course, wait till it's properly trained, and then you would require the cat to perform this behavior before getting fed. And if it didn't, you simply put the food away, walk away and do something else, come back sometime later, you know, not 5 or 10 minutes later, but a time to develop an even greater hunger, you know, maybe 3 or 4 hours later, and try it again, or try it again that night. And eventually the cat will respond, because to obey and get the food is, you know, the most powerful instinct at that time. And, you know, it's almost like forcing it to respect your wishes and follow your commands.
Now, the impulse when your cat bites you is to smack it, throw it across the room and say, "No, bad cat." And you've said, "No yelling, no hitting." I mean, why not? Doesn't that show that you're the boss, too, if you can smack your cat around and holler
well,
a lot?
Well, I mean, you know, I guess I go completely the opposite view from that. I don't believe that, you know, an aggressive response to a cat or a dog or a child is really an appropriate way with dealing with a situation that, you know, perhaps is frustrating at the time. And, you know, a sort of better punishment, if you will, is sort of time out. And that is, you know, if a cat is behaving badly, you would stand up and walk away and do something else. And the punishment, as it were, is just the withdrawal of the company, your company, that it was previously enjoying.
If you're just joining us, my guest is veterinarian Dr. Nicholas Dodman, and his new book is called The Cat Who Cried for Help: Attitudes, Emotions, and the Psychology of Cats. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with veterinarian Dr. Nicholas Dodman, author of the new book, The Cat Who Cried for Help, which is a book about cat psychology. You've talked about dominant cats and the kind of aggressive behavior that they demonstrate and how to control that. But there's also aggressive behavior that cats can display if the cat is kind of cooped up in a very small apartment and it's just not getting enough exercise. There's a certain kind of aggressive behavior that's really just playfulness. The cat's really just playing, but he's playing by, you know, biting you. How can you tell which is that kind of dominant cat behavior and which is just being cooped up or just a kind of misdirected playfulness, because you can't really treat it, can you, unless you know what the cause is.
Well, kittens will often, you know, bite people. And, you know, in the book I describe, you know, numerous telephone calls that we get to the behavior clinic saying, you know, my cat is psychotic, you know, my cat is schizophrenic. And then you say, well, you know, how old is it? And the answer is 6 months old, you know, because it's, you know, having fits of the maddies and biting the people in the hand and jumping out from, you know, when they get out of the shower and biting them in the feet when they walk past a corner and so on. And this is all sort of kittenish, playish behavior, which, you know, you need to understand that particularly when you have a single kitten, it has a drive inside it to play. It's part of normal development. It's a perfectly natural thing to want to do. And there's kind of social play and predatory play. And if it's the only kitten in the house, you're likely to be the subject of that. So there are ways that you can defuse it by understanding the need for these behaviors and redirecting them away from yourself, but allowing them to express themselves, you know, towards an appropriate target, for example, a little, you know, sort of toy mouse on a string that's dragged along. But, you know, that behavior with the little kitten who might, for example, sit on your lap and bite you in the hand if you're petting it is, you know, again, my view is that this is an early sign of, you know, what could later become a fully mature dominant cat. And it should be nipped in the bud in the sense of learning when to stop petting the cat and learning to send it clear signals that you don't, you know, like that kind of behavior.
Do you find that some pet owners become afraid of their cats?
Absolutely, yeah. But some have very good reason to become afraid. I mean, we've been talking a lot about dominance, aggression, and, you know, it isn't as common in cats as it is in dogs, and, you know, it is something that can be reasonably controlled. But aggression through fear, sometimes redirected from some other source, can be, you know, just a horrific experience, you know, and people can get totally shaken by it, and they can lose all faith of even living inside the same airspace as the cat. I mean, they just feel threatened, because cats are pretty formidable creatures when they get themselves riled. I mean, one example, for example, of redirected aggression was, I think I did mention it in the book, it's a lady's friend brought a baby round, and this cat had never seen a young infant before. The infant was sort of crying and flailing on a bed, and the cat started to sort of puff up and get into this sort of defensive rage sort of picture. Its pupils started to dilate, its tail started to puff up, it started to arch its back, and the observant owner said to the lady with the baby, "Time for you to leave." She left quickly, leaving the owner and the riled cat. So the cat then redirected its hostilities onto the owner and started to walk towards her in a menacing way. And to cut a long story short, had that owner backed up in her own kitchen with a broom, defending herself for 7 hours.
Wow.
The next day, it was all over, but it was a very frightening incident. And sometimes cats can have this sort of hot and cold, you know, they'll be okay for a period of time, but then they kind of get into a mode and will start to stalk and attack, and you know, it can be quite intimidating.
Well, we've been talking about cat aggression, and that's a big problem for a lot of cat owners. But the biggest problem that cat owners face is cats that urinate or defecate outside of the litter box. So I think we need to talk about that. Is there a certain type of litter box that alienates a cat, that a cat finds unpleasant?
Yes. Let me just back up just a second. That certainly is a yes to that question. You know, this problem of cats not using the litter box, I mean, if it becomes a chronic feature in your life with your cat and your home starts to smell of urine and your rugs are being ruined, I mean, it is one of the reasons why people take their cat to, you know, shelter or pound, and the likely consequence then is that the cat will be put to sleep. So, you know, it's something which we definitely need to be able to give advice on and to treat. And the success rate now is very high. I mean, we have about a 95% success rate with this condition. And it's not really one condition. It's like three conditions rolled into one. The first one, which must be ruled out by your local vet, is medical. And conditions like, for example, cystitis, the FUS syndrome, that's the feline urological syndrome, a constellation of medical conditions and diabetes and such, should be ruled out first, and vets are pretty good at doing that. The second thing is just plain old litterbox aversion, where for some reason the cat is not comfortable with the present sort of latrine arrangements within its home. And in answer to your question more directly, most cats, for example, prefer unhooded litter boxes. Most cats prefer the sort of sand texture litters to the more granular ones, which, you know, might be the equivalent of walking on a stony beach without shoes on for us. Most cats prefer litters that aren't scented. So, and most cats, you know, you need a certain formula, a sort of relationship of the number of boxes in the house to the number of cats you've got. I describe one case in the book where a lady had six cats and two boxes, and that was an accident looking for a place to happen. You need one box per cat plus one, especially when you're trying to unravel a problem. And then there's a third category, which has come to light recently, of cats who really urinate outside the box as a marking behavior and through anxiety combined with sort of territoriality. And that's one where we've made the most advances recently. And again, it's a, you know, an environmental plus medical solution. I omitted to say that, of course, entire male cats who, you know, haven't been castrated will almost invariably mark their territory, and neutering is a very efficient solution to that particular problem.
How can you diagnose whether the inappropriate defecation or urination is a sign of a behavior problem as opposed to that the cat doesn't like the litter that you're using?
Well, you know, just it's a bit of an art, but there is quite a simple way, and sort of a way that I've sort of worked out for myself is how interesting is the problem. So what I mean by that is if somebody came to me and said, my cat is not using its litter box, my next question is, well, where is it going? And they say, well, it goes in the corner of a room on a, you know, shag pile carpet behind the wingback chair, and it sometimes goes in the bedroom behind my nightstand. Those kind of rather boring manifestations, you know, the cat always goes in two different, you know, maybe one or two different places, usually on a flat surface, often on a rug, and basically chooses not to use its litter box at all, is an indication the cat is simply using the rug as a bathroom. So I call that the more boring problems, whereas the marking behaviors are really a lot of fun, in a way, to diagnose, because the cat goes in a number of, you know, highly almost amusing locations. For example, on a person's desk, you know, they frequently go on a bureau, they go on a stovetop, they'll go on a piece of electrical equipment, they'll urinate, and often on vertical surfaces, you know, against the drapes which are in front of the window. They'll urinate on small volumes on a heating register, you know, we believe because, you know, there are odors carried on the updraft through the register that the cat is trying to neutralize or at least stake its claim to. They'll go on people's clothing. They'll actually urinate on people as they're lying in bed sleeping. They'll come up and, you know, in a way of a compliment, really, they'll urinate on your face. And what they're trying to say is whatever they're marking is, this belongs to me. It's almost like an insecurity. They feel the need to go around leaving their business card all over the place, including on people and people's clothes. So, you know, as I say, kind of an interesting assortment of places, including vertical surfaces and so on.
Say your cat is using your rug in the living room as the bathroom. What can you do to get the cat back in the litter box?
You definitely need to do a thorough cleanup. And a lot of people don't realize this. They're running around with, you know, ammonia sprays and whatever, which smell like urine. And the only treatment really is sort of serial dilution of the area with sort of warm water that's at best soapy, you know, no harsh chemicals, because the harsh chemicals will inactivate stage two, which is mandatory. Stage two is to purchase an odor neutralizer, not a masker, a neutralizer, something that contains enzymes that will break down the molecules that cause the smell. And that is vital because a cat will be attracted back to a previously soiled spot as surely as a heat-seeking missile to a source of heat.
Do you ever recommend sending a cat out to like a discipline school, a training school?
Absolutely not. You know, it would be pointless. I don't think there's much to be gained from sending a dog away to a discipline school, and with a cat, it's, you know, even less point from, you know, even more pointless.
Why?
Well, I always think that the problem exists in the home, in the context that it's occurring, and the relationship with the person is sort of pivotal in that, because, you know, the relationship you have with a pet is a sort of what's referred to as a dyadic, and there's two sides, and it's interactive. And to separate the sort of human companion animal bond down the middle and treat each half of the equation as a separate entity, to me, doesn't make sense.
What if it's a school? What if it's a school where the owner and the pet are together?
I guess, you know, I mean, I still don't recommend it myself. I mean, it's just not part of my practice. And I prefer, for example, you know, with dog training, to have the owners work with the dog in the home for 5 or 10 minutes twice a day. If necessary, have someone come to the home and show them what to do. And for it to be a consistent sort of daily thing, the way they interact should be something from dawn till dusk. It's not something you can just do for an hour a week.
Dr. Nicholas Dodman is the author of The Cat Who Cried for Help. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with veterinarian Nicholas Dodman. His new book is called The Cat Who Cried for Help, Attitudes, Emotions, and the Psychology of Cats. He's also the author of a book about dogs called The Dog Who Loved Too Much. He directs the behavior clinic at the Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. You have often prescribed mood altering drugs for pets, and we talked about this a little bit recently when you were on the show a few weeks ago, but I'm interested in hearing more about how you decided to pursue that direction. We're talking here about Prozac and other mood altering drugs that we associate with people, not with pets.
Well, I guess in a former life, I was a veterinary anesthesiologist and became very familiar with, you know, all drugs and physiology was sort of my, you know, main bent. And sort of in the early 1980s, I did a sort of an epic experiment with colleague Dr. Lou Schuster from the medical school. He's a pharmacologist. And we found, for example, that in the compulsive behavior of cribbing, which is where horses grab hold of the edge of their stall and lean back and tense their large neck muscles, and they do it over and over again, we found that if you blocked nature's own morphine-like substances, the so-called endorphins, that the behavior was totally prevented. And that really was what started me with my interest in behavior, was this, you know, black and white experiment where this behavior was so simply controlled by one neurotransmitter, or, if you like, sort of chemical in the brain. And that was my, you know, bias, was to think about problems in a, you know, what some people would call a reductionist view. Specifically with the cats, what happened is, you know, in about 1987, I was talking to my neighbor who was practically pulling his hair out because terrible things were happening in his life. His daughter was smashing his car, his father had died, and money was short, and he couldn't sleep at night, and he developed a nervous tic in his eye. And he said he was given a particular medicine that helped him, and it was called Buspirone. Well, I was really quite put out because I'd never heard of this drug or the class that it belonged to. And so I set about investigating it and found out that it was free of side effects, that it reduced anxiety, that it was non-addictive. It was one of a new group of smart drugs. And, you know, basically, it was about as noxious as a, you know, drink of water. So if it worked, it would be, you know, a boon to cats. And we found out, Dr. Schuster and myself found out, that actually it did work to reduce anxiety in cats, made them very friendly and affectionate, and reduced some anxiety-based conditions like the anxiety-related marking behavior. And we took out a United States patent on that idea, which we still have, and we're trying to find a company who'd be interested in developing the drug for this, the number one behavior problem in cats. And that led, you know, the anxiety treatment in cats led to investigation of other drugs, including the antidepressant family. And I sort of picked up where other people had left off with the antidepressant amitriptyline, which can also, or trade name is Elavil, which can also help to treat, for example, separation anxiety and inappropriate elimination. And then, you know, early in the 1990s, I don't know whether it was 1990, 91, we started using Prozac because it increases brain serotonin and theoretically, and in fact in practice, reduces aggression, reduces anxiety, and is just about the only treatment for one of an interesting new group of behavior problems that, well, they're old problems with a new tag called compulsive behaviors, including so-called wool sucking and sort of hair pulling in cats that is psychogenic.
The fact that you've found that cats respond often to mood-altering drugs, does that say anything to you about the connections between cat and human psychology?
Well, it does. You know, they had a Frasier show on the other day where the sort of pet psychiatrist came in and was sort of really, you know, laughed off the stage by Frasier and his brother Niles. But in fact, that isn't the situation. That a lot of the things we're doing are very interesting to psychiatrist colleagues. Not that I would want to be one. I'm happy being a vet. But, you know, the fact that other animals on this planet show states of mind and respond to medicines the same as humans is very interesting from, you know, basic biological point of view. And we've identified a number of different behaviors that respond the same way. I mean, I listened the other day to a few years ago, actually, to Dr. John Ratey from Massachusetts, who wrote a book about attention deficit disorder in children, and he's an aggression expert. It turns out that he uses the same drugs to treat aggression in aggressive human patients in mental hospital as we do to treat very aggressive animals when you know they're extremely aggressive. It turns out that we use the same drugs to treat anxiety, and this is developed in isolation. It's not necessarily just because they're used in human medicine. And the compulsive behaviors, like obsessive compulsive disorder in people, also respond to the same gamut. And what it means to me is it's another store of evidence to answer that, you know, question of all time: do animals think? Do they have emotions? And it's a fairly heavy store of evidence that says yes, in fact, they probably do experience emotions, and they do have intelligence, and they do think, including cats and dogs, and horses, and probably other mammals too. And that sometimes, you know, their behaviors can be, you know, as complicated as you know, and their emotional states as complicated as those of man, responding to a similar array of psychotropic drugs.
Well, Dr. Nicholas Dodman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Nicholas Dodman is the author of The Cat Who Cried for Help. He directs the behavior clinic at the Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine.